today.
Is that true?
Yeah. We started writing all the scripts in December of last year. I was really bummed because I was like, we'll do the 12 Days of Enneagram Christmas. And then I was like, this is a ton of work.
Yeah, this is a lot. Yeah, and I think it ended up being great because I think we got, like, everybody got much more in detail, going kind of slow burning our way through it.
This is going to be a little bit different version of the podcast.
Oh, now we're talking to you, viewers. See,
yeah.
We eased into this just like it was just us, just casually chit-chatting, but... No, we know you're here.
We know you're listening. We know you're creeping.
Have a seat.
Take it easy.
Sit down.
Uncork your own bottle of wine.
Chill out. Have some of the sacrament.
Unless you're driving, which you probably are.
Yeah, hey, if you're driving, don't crack that bottle of wine. You wait until you get home.
Not yet. Ease into it.
I think that there is something really human about... We seem to subconsciously know, as human beings, that... The scariest place to go is in. Hmm. The scariest place to have to examine is to go inside of ourselves and be like, all right, what's really motivating me? Yeah. What am I really frightened of?
I mean, that's why I want to applaud everybody that did an episode for us on the Enneagram, because the Enneagram naturally pulls things out of you that you maybe haven't thought of in a year or two or even a decade.
Yeah.
And then you realize, well, not only am I now having to think about my relationship to my mom, I have to tell random people downloading this and listening to it in their car about my relationship to my mom or my dad or my brother or my spouse. And I think that was the most telling part of it, was like, no matter what your personality is, the deeper part of you, which is your essence in Enneagram speak, is always a little fearful of coming out. There's always a little bit of fear of that exposure, and I think that's the natural part of any, you know, soul work that we do, and that's the beautiful part of the Enneagram, and also why we get a little skeptical if someone's like, woohoo, Enneagram, let's talk about it. You're like, really? You want to go into this rabbit hole about your trauma and what makes you tick?
Right. Yeah, I think it's harder to get super, super stoked about than something like Myers-Briggs or Strength Finders, just because that's sort of like, again, it's that like, oh, what are you? Like, what do you identify as? Like, what's your identification? And I think there's that illusion of like, I'm an INTJ or I'm an ESFP. And then it's like, ah, I got you. Like, I know there is a temptation to do that with the Enneagram.
Right.
And I feel that temptation because I'm newer to the Enneagram than you are. So for me, there is still like quite a bit of that enthusiasm, and it's really easy for me to want to like talk about other people's numbers and to want to like try to like identify. It comes from an honest, like, good place. It doesn't come from, like, wanting to, like, beat anybody over the head with it. It comes from, like, let's, like, navigate you.
But you naturally, like, will hold court talking just about things you suck at or are afraid of.
Yeah.
Or recently that were horrible experiences you just had.
Yeah, that's true.
Polar opposite of me, where I'm like, wow, I would tell you this in a one-on-one conversation, you know, at my house, but not broadcast it as soon as I walk into a party or something.
Well,
you know,
here's what the Enneagram does. It's really easy for me to be like, I struggle with depression. I've had suicidal thoughts. Look at how dark and interesting I am. That takes no effort for me.
Yeah.
What is scary for me is to be like, you know what? At the root of that is a real self-obsession and some real selfishness and this belief that, like, I just deserve more than I have because deep down, I think I'm really, really special. And there's a bitterness or an anger at not being able to demonstrate that all the time.
I wonder, because I think one of the dangerous things about the Enneagram is it can be a tool to become more narcissistic.
Yes,
it can be it just gives you a wealth of like new words to talk about yourself if that's the way you want to go with it. So how do you use it in a way that doesn't enable that kind of thought or behavior, you know?
For me, I can only speak for myself. For me, it's reminding myself of the good that I can exhibit. Mm-hmm. There is like the positive directions that my number can go when I do just treat myself a little bit better and show myself a little bit more kindness. And also, I mean, with my number as a 4, every Enneagram reminder will be like, get a little bit out of your feelings, remind yourself of the importance of others, and remember that your feelings aren't everything.
Yeah.
So like, that's a constant reminder for me, no, regardless of where I look or what I read. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, hey, you have a tendency to be selfish. The way you do that, the way you counteract that is just by kind of taking a step back and accepting that it's okay to be a little normal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's such a simple, small thing, but it can help in a time of crisis. Mm-hmm. It can help to realize that everybody's got problems.
Yeah.
Everybody's got hurt. And my hurt is not as unique as I might think it is. I just might talk about it a lot more than somebody else.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing about 4s, who, since they are quote unquote individualists, is it exposes something about the Enneagram as a whole, which is we all think we're different than the other people that are like, that have the same number.
Right.
I've seen that so much where, because a lot of the people that did the Enneagram, all of them were our friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, someone hears an episode and they're like, oh, they're this number? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not like them, but I'm that number. Are you sure that they're that number? Or am I sure I am this number? Because it's, you have to see people in a new way, which cuts out that whole, well, I uniquely do X, Y, Z. So therefore I'm like no one else, or I'm not like people I don't like.
Yeah.
Which is, I think is, that's the case more often than I just want to be an individual. It's, I don't want to be like other people I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like as soon as anyone says Trump is an 8, the other eights are like, oh, fuck that guy. Like, I'm not an 8.
Right.
Fuck him. You know? Right. And like, it's like, well, think about the diversity of this perspective.
Yeah, I also love that some people think that, like, it's totally possible that Martin Luther King Jr. may have been an 8.
Yeah.
Instead of feeling happy, I feel sort of let down. I know how you feel about all this Christmas business, getting depressed and all that. It happens to me every year.
That's my favorite thing about it, is that there's, for each number, there's this spectrum.
Uh-huh.
And that's, I think that's the most encouraging thing for me about it. Because my number is all, you know, suicidal, drug-addled, like, poets and rock stars.
You know, actually, all 9 types can get suicidal.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I think there's that difference between personality and essence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when you read into the Enneagram Institute's work on the Enneagram, personality is what you wear on the outside. Personality is what you're picking apart at. Personality has the flaws and the dark side. Your essence is kind of the pure thing about you, the pure thing that is good, that doesn't judge or lie or whatever. It's just the unique little gem of you. And I think the personality is what we've come to celebrate and focus on in culture and society. And if there's a big enough dissonance between the personality you're wearing and the essence of who you are, I think that ends. That's why people end their life. They just can't, rationalize, or they can't align those two. They become so dissonant that I think people just get lost in it. They get lost in despair, or they just become hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a hopeless disconnect. Like they can't plug into the conduit of life. So they're just kind of constantly having to generate their own energy. Mm-hmm. And that's why you see like middle-aged men just peter out and kill themselves, because it's like you have that kind of energy in your youth and you maybe your teens and your 20s and your 30s, and then you become 40 and 50, you just run out of gas.
Yeah.
And I think the only time that you are fully charged up and fully energized is when you are kind of, your essence is like plugged in, and your essence is getting fed by your job and by your friends and by your alone time. Like, you have to feed it more than anyone else by just being able to sit in alone in a room with yourself. Because like, what's that quote, like, the root of all human misery is an inability to sit in a room without stimulus.
Yeah. What do you think is the, I mean, in this last year where Enneagram has been kind of like a key focus for both of us, what do you think is the biggest thing you've learned through the Enneagram? I was going to try to come up with like a second part to that question.
I think it's a good question. I think it's actually from, I read this in Richard Rohr's Christmas devotional this morning, but he was talking about if new ideas and intellectual change aren't accompanied by heart change, it won't last. Mm-hmm. It won't last long at all. As I have been fortunate enough to do this with 9 of my friends, you know, they all kind of become running case studies. Mm-hmm. So all 9 of us, 10 if you count me, you know, it's interesting to see how the heart work plays out. Once you lean into the Enneagram and you find out these new things and you find out how other people are seeing you, you have like this new level of accountability. And especially if you're living life in a community, you really get to see who leans into that new accountability. And most of all, you're accountable to yourself more so than anyone else. I think the thing I've learned is all of these fascinating ideas and, you know, novel insight into what makes me tick, it's so fleeting unless it's a constant effort to return to it and a constant effort to just sit with myself and accept who I am. Mm-hmm. And all of the flaws and have hope for the new reconciliation I can have with myself, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the biggest thing I've learned. Like the heart change is like 90% of it. This novel fun part of new insight is great. And we get the 10% is what people get excited about. Like, yeah. Oh, I'm a 1. I go to 7. My best friend's a 7. It makes sense why we hang out. Oh, you know,
right.
That's delightful. And if that 10% leads you to the other 90, then I'm like, hooray. But I think that cracking into the rest of the work is just so difficult.
What do you think that 90% looks like? What do you think that heart work looks like?
For me, I think it just looks like a lot of meditation, a lot of contemplation, therapy. It looks like a lot of tough conversations with yourself. I mean, for me, one of my examples, I guess, would be me and Danielle, my fiance, have a lot of hard conversations one-on-one about fights we've had, issues that we have. But when we started doing marriage counseling, we had to rehash the fight in front of a counselor. Mm. And that was a whole nother level. Mm-hmm. That was like, he would just ask us like, well, what did that fight look like? And we were like, well, you know, we solved it. She said this, I said that, there was an apology. And then we decided from now on we'd do this. And he's like, so when you played it out, like, what was your point of view? And then it almost created another argument because there was more hurt and there were deeper opinions about how the world should be. So I think a lot of times that self-work looks like cracking back down into some issue you think you've solved. And being like, you know what, if I'm honest with myself, I keep having this problem with my friends. I may have found a way to dodge it with my spouse or with Dan, mm-hmm. but damn, when I make a new friend, it's like one of the first things that we have a fight about.
Mm.
Or when I get a new job, I have like the same fight with my new boss that I thought I solved with my old boss.
Damn.
And so it's these weird cyclical behaviors where I think our flaws are really... they're really fucking squirrely. Like, they just move. They move and dodge. There's parts of us that don't want to heal. And so they adapt and they transform into new ways of manifesting. So, you know, me and you both know someone who did therapy, intense therapy for 30 days in a retreat facility, mm-hmm. got treated for all sorts of depression and mental behaviors, came out and within weeks was doing worse behaviors in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
It just, and felt, he felt healed.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between like a detox and like real hardcore therapy for a long time. I think therapy takes a long
time.
Yeah,
I mean, you've done both.
Well,
I don't know what your detox is like, but
to be honest, my I think like the biggest thing in this past year with the Enneagram is it got me to a point where doing all this internal stuff and kind of like having a similar experience where all of a sudden there's like a new person in my life, in my dating life. There's this new human being right. that I don't have a history with, and I don't have, we don't have any like shared, like, you know, we know some of the same people, but that's about the extent of it. We don't have like a shared history or commonality. So here's a brand new person dropped into my life, and all this stuff that I kind of thought I had a handle on just starts like cropping up again.
God. Yeah.
Like in really kind of destructive, sabotage-y ways for me. And she's not doing anything to poke and prod it. And I think the biggest thing for the Enneagram was getting to, with me, I came to this point where I was like, okay, I am enjoying, seems like a weird word for it, but I am enjoying doing all of this introspection and soul work. It gives me a sense of direction. It gives me a sense of grounding. I feel like I'm getting into stuff that I've never gotten into before, learning to accept myself in a way that I never have before. But I came to a very real point where I was like, now I'm getting into stuff that I don't know how to navigate by myself.
Yeah.
I'm running into, and this was a few months back. This was before anything in my dating life. Like, I came to this on my own, but things just started cropping up again, whether it was subconsciously, anxiety started coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this very real sensation of like, what the fuck is that?
Yeah.
Like, where did this come from? I haven't thought about this in 10 years. Like, yeah. What is this? And realizing like, oh, I need help. I need somebody to guide me through this, or at bare minimum, like a professional who can just like walk alongside me.
Yeah.
So that I can be like, hey, here's what I'm thinking. Can you help me with this? Can you help me process this? I don't know how.
Man, I'm a big believer that there are things that will only come out of us in a romantic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you have like a friendship, non-sexual, that you are with them all the time for years. Because for me, I struggle with rage, just tons of anger. And with friends, as I gotten older, I feel like I was able to lock it down more and more. I feel like you can attest to that. Like, I'd have snaps or blow-ups or be really judgmental. And then every year that we hung out in the same group, I feel like it went down, and it went down a little bit. And it would come out, but it wouldn't be, like, the same. But then with romantic relationships, it would just, like, I would hit the fucking roof over little things. And then I would be like, I thought I fixed this with so-and-so 5 years ago. I thought after I had that big fight with her and I said all those nasty things, it never came up again. You know, granted, we broke up and it didn't work out, but I just have been working on it. I can't believe all these years later, same thing, stupid fight, still feel my heart racing, you know, saying nasty things. Like, after all of that work, all of those hard conversations, that's what I'm saying. Like, I think it's just squirrely. Like, these issues we deal with,
they're like viruses, man. They don't want to be beat.
And
like,
I think they only come up in relationships.
They want to adapt, and they want to fuck shit up.
Yeah.
Because it's. I think they're like connected to the ego in a way that they believe they're like overactive white blood cells. They believe they are helping us, but they're cancerous.
Yeah. That's a good metaphor.
They believe they're defending us. Like, you know, man, I'm gonna start getting like really personal, but okay, so for
me, we don't do that on this podcast.
Yeah, I don't want to get too real. I want to keep this distant. I have this addiction to my expectations, to this fantasized reality of what I want my life to look like, and it totally prevents me from like real life, current, present happiness, because I have this beautifully imagined fantasy world that I'm like, oh, if I can just create that, if I can just create that career or that marriage or that life, man, that's what I got to do. I got to create that. And then the minute I start to stumble upon a little bit of happiness in the real world, a little bit of like authentic joy, a little bit of simple, just like, hey, this isn't grandiose, but I am really happy doing this thing or spending time with this person or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's like when you're on a walk to Trader Joe's and you're why am I so content?
This, like, it's a beautiful day.
Yeah.
The trees are blooming. Mm-hmm. This is beautiful. Then it's like, yeah, but dude, We got all these expectations, man. These expectations that you've imagined are so much better than all of this. And it's like, in a way, it's this weird sort of protective, like, don't settle for the simple things because we've like imagined this grandeur. And I'm like, that feels to me, I don't think that's universal for everybody, but that it may be.
I think that's
and that
the,
feels cancerous.
That's the personality essence thing. Like, I think there's stages of, you can call it the ego instead mm-hmm. of personality.
Right.
It's the stripping away of the ego, the thing that you're projecting. So like if you're a 3 instead of a 4, your thing is like, I'm so capable and I'm so high achieving and I'm so successful. What would it look like if I just fucking wasn't the CEO of this company, or I wasn't, you know, making 100K and I lived in a little studio? What would people think?
What would people think is so huge.
I think for me, it's moral. It's like, what if you fucked up something? Like, what if this relationship failed? Or like, what if you did the worst thing ever? You had an affair. Like, your whole, to me, it's just like, that's why I struggle with people who like have these amazing fuck ups and go down in flames and they just expect people to still stick around. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
I'm like,
yeah.
You're bananas. Like, I feel like if I did a tenth of what you did, people would just run out the door and never talk to me again. And so it's that same fear of like, can I admit my flaws? For me, that's what it is. Not like my fantasy life, but it is just say like, here's something I do wrong. Here's something I did bad. Here's something I knew was really messed up and I still did it.
Yeah.
You know, and being able to talk about that kind of stuff. And you're just like, some people may leave and that may affirm my fear. And then I'll revert to this really moralistic point of view. But then some people show up and shock you, you know?
Yeah.
People like you have done that for me.
You know, creative artists, you know, they might not vocalize it, but how many people only want to be an actor if it really, really goes to the big times?
Yeah.
How many people want to be a comedian, but only if they're able to become famous?
I think this all ties into self-awareness is the antithesis of oftentimes what your greatest quote unquote dream is. It brings you back down to, but why? I want to be a pastor. I want to be an actor. I want to be a fashion designer. I want to be a coach. I want to be a musician. Why?
Yeah.
Why? And I think those are the conversations I personally love, and those are the conversations you cannot avoid with the Enneagram
yeah.
for long if you do it well.
What I think I love about the Enneagram is that it seems like for every number, the real key to happiness and peace for that number is the thing you do not do naturally. There seems to be this discipline piece for every number. The thing that goes against your like high-minded ego self, your presentational, this is what I must do self. It's the thing that subverts that.
Yeah.
That's like, there is real peace.
Yeah.
So like for the 4, my drive to be special, to be unique, to be seen as romantically individualistic and just such a precious little snowflake. There is deep, serene peace for me in being able to just be a part of a community and just be like,
yeah.
That doesn't mean that I need to diminish myself, but like there is peace in being able to be myself and that not needing to be crazy attention grabbing. I don't have to have everybody's eyes on me to be happy. There might be more peace in letting that go.
Yeah.
I think like for like a 6 who is prone towards like fear and anxiety, then it's really just little acts of courage. It's little acts of trusting people and letting people in. Those things that feel like, no, I need to protect myself because people are bad and will hurt me, which there's plenty of evidence for. But there's a natural like joy that comes in just displaying courage.
Yeah.
I think like
it's a deeper lasting peace.
Yeah.
Than an immediate shot of happiness.
Right.
Because I think that's mostly what those areas of integration and disintegration are pointing at, is where do you move to get your shot of happiness and where do you go to get your lasting joy?
Mm-hmm.
Because I go to you to get a shot of happiness, like to the four, or to the unhealthy side of the four.
Right. Which, what is that? What do you think that looks like for you?
For me, it's just like pulling the ripcord and going and indulging in something. It could be fast mm-hmm. food. It could be, back in the day, it was a lot of poor relationship decisions.
Mm-hmm.
It's the antithesis of the standards to which I hold myself.
Yeah.
That's what the going to four was, you know, being a gypsy and just running away and having no structure.
No ties, yeah.
Yeah, no structure, no self-discipline. Fuck it. Let's just go. Life's short. Let's have fun. But it's interesting because I feel like sevens look like that a little bit. Sevens being the enthusiast, traveling the world. And I can still do that same thing. And again, it's the why.
Yeah.
It can be that crazy 6-week trip to Zimbabwe. And it's not, I'm not running away. Like, I'm not running away from doing the right thing. I'm leaning into a really hard decision that is cutting loose of structure, and it's cutting loose of predictability and all of these standards that I've set up for myself, because life is short.
Yeah.
And I want to do some good. So it's tricky, man. I think everybody's progress looks wildly different from the next person, and unless you're the same type, it might look very similar. But I mean, one of the big things that happens in fights with me is I usually tend to say, well, like, well, I didn't do anything wrong. So mm-hmm. if you're looking for an apology, like, I didn't really do anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard for me to feel sorry for what you're feeling. And the area for growth is just kind of, even if it feels not genuine, to lead with some sort of contrition, even if it's just like scraping the barrel to find something to apologize for.
Right.
And I'm so bad at it, and it feels so unnatural.
Right.
But it goes over well.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like,
I have to work on not apologizing.
Yeah. And it being like, so and so said this. They should stand up to what they should do, what they said they were going to do.
Right.
I'm doing my job. They need to do theirs. And the whole thing works well. As opposed to like, you're right, I'm sorry, I should have covered for you. I should have.
Yeah. Yeah, even just something in it, like as small as, you know, it's like the boundaries, the boundary conversation. And there's so much of growth is just learning about your boundaries and how to protect your boundaries.
Yeah.
And I've really come to realize I really, really respect a person who has boundaries and can defend their boundaries.
Yeah.
Like, it is not offensive to me. It sometimes might force me to change my plans or whatever, but it's not like, it's not deeply offensive.
Yeah.
People like people who are agreeable.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people that are agreeable to a fault.
Man. Nice people don't change, though. I take an asshole over a nice person any day of the week.
Whoa, what a statement. Nice people don't change.
They don't change. The only people who change in the Bible are assholes, are fucked up people, you know, shady individuals. All the nice people are like, no, I got it all handled. I don't hurt anyone. I pay my taxes. I follow the Sabbath rules. Like, I go
it's
to
like
church.
A superficial niceness. It's not a truly deep like quality character.
Yeah. No, to me, I just think niceness is superficial.
Mm-hmm.
And think, what I'm talking about is like kindness.
Goodness.
Yeah. Faith. The action, you can want to dive into the fruits. It never says nice.
No.
And Brene Brown has that amazing quote where she talked about understanding vulnerability and shame. And she says, now that I've like matured and grown, I'm a lot less nice, but I'm a lot more loving.
I love that.
And I'm like, fuck yes.
Yeah.
Because I need to err towards trying to be nice, and I'll probably land on kind just because of my personality. Tends to err on, you know, critical and sharp and abrasive. So I'm aiming for nice only to land on kind.
Yeah.
But if you're aiming at nice in and of itself, and that's like a default position just so you don't offend anyone, oof. Enneagram cut through that shit. You ask a nice guy to deal with the Enneagram, you'll find out real fast how honest he is or she is.
I definitely, we've talked about this before, but I definitely wrestle with the fact that, like, as you dive into doing soul work and introspective work, you dive into your boundaries and how to protect them. you very quickly realize how few people are doing that, and you start to feel very, very lonely.
Yeah.
Your pool of people you can be close to gets real small. Yeah. It gets scary small.
I have yet to find someone healthy and older. No. I've yet to find someone healthy and over the age of 30 that told me their social circle got bigger as they got healthier.
Yeah.
It thins the herd because you just realize how many of your relationships were built on some sort of selfish behavior.
Right.
Even if it's like a harmless selfish behavior, like we're roommates. Mm-hmm. That's not anything maniacal, but it is convenient that you come home to the same house that I do, and then we can have a beer.
Yeah.
So it's like we used to hang out all the time. It's like, well, yeah.
Yeah, it's that kind of like as we get older, there's no time as you get older in your life. There's no time to just like chill. Like, yeah. I'm not really looking for people that I can just like chill with. Time is so valuable and social time is valuable.
Yeah.
So you're really looking for people that you can have like close, intimate relationships and friendships with. And that's different than just chilling.
Yeah.
I think that like there will be occasional chill sessions. I don't know. Everything gets harder as you get older. You have to become so much more intentional about all of this stuff. And okay, how do I phrase this? Because we've polished off a bottle of wine. You cannot use the ladder of success as a gauge for health. Because you can climb very, very high up the ladder having never done real work on yourself. As a matter of fact, I think some of the people who are the highest up that rung have done the least amount of work on themselves because they just didn't designate any time to it.
Brother.
They're playing the game.
Brother. Nothing makes me feel more like a secluded, crazy person sometimes than seeing communities I've been a part of celebrate people that I know are basically down and out, except for their Instagram looks great.
Yeah.
And their career is popping, and they make a really good living.
Yeah, name names.
It's really tough, man. It's really tough when you know people are going about it in a really unhealthy direction, which is a judgment. So then I question myself because ones tend to judge things on right or wrong, healthy, unhealthy. But I've been so close to people for years when I've watched their interpersonal decisions, their decisions with their family, decisions with their work. And you're like, that's shady. And everyone is celebrating you and what you're saying. And I think one of my biggest fears is becoming like an insight broker. Mm-hmm. And a broker is someone who just holds something while it's going between two transactional parties. So like, if you're selling a house and you own the house and you're selling it to a new resident, I as a broker will like hold the house while you guys figure out a deal.
Yeah.
But I don't own anything. Like I don't own the house. I have no stake in any of this. I make a living on just holding it while you two figure out what you think about it and who's going to get it. And I feel like there's so many people in LA, in the world, influencers, entrepreneurs, whatever, pastors who are like insight brokers where they're like, so-and-so said it, you need it, I will hold it for you and I will present it and I will describe it eloquently for you, but I don't own this shit. This ain't mine.
Yeah.
I'm not a 18th century mystic. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I didn't
like,
create it.
I don't have any ownership over this shit. Like, I show up and there's lights in a band, and I just repeat it for you. I'm the Carlos Mencia of fucking insight or entrepreneurial work. Here you go. Yeah. Oh, well, of course, we're all referencing somebody, and like, who's original? Originality is the cancer of artists. So, you know, all these, you could back it up and defend it all you want.
Yeah.
It's borderline plagiarism, but it's also, it does some good. And that's where Paul, I think, talks about it, where he's like, you know what? Some people are spouting off the gospel and they're full of shit, but you know what? If it does good for the kingdom, then I just let them be.
Mm-hmm.
I just let them be. You guys will call him an antichrist. You guys will be all up in arms about false prophets. But you know what? Some of them are doing good and life's too short. So I just say, fuck it. And that's what, as one with like righteousness and wisdom and dealing with anger, it's so hard to let go of.
Yeah.
And the Enneagram is like a thing I love. And I just cringe when I see people that are like information brokers get their teeth into it for like 6 weeks to get a following and to increase their likes and then bounce and leave it. That's why I wanted to revisit it. I'm like, I know we launched this months ago. We've been working on it for a year, but we should cycle back through it. Like, this is really important. And 9 individuals put their lives out there
mm-hmm.
to promote this and to be under the microscope. Like, let's give it, you know, 12 more days. Let's give it 2 more weeks and go back through it and try to harness a little bit more insight if we can, because this should be a lifelong journey in my mind.
Yeah.
And it's lonely and no one praises you for it. And no one likes it
yeah.
when you put up boundaries or when you air your dirty laundry and that kind of reflects poorly on them. Like if you're a wife and you air your dirty laundry, that may reflect poorly on your husband or your family or your kids, because we're all connected.
Yeah.
So that's my 2 cents on that.
Hey, I don't know if you're still out there listening. I don't know if you guys realize this, but all of the production, and we've gotten lots and lots of compliments specifically on the podcast production. That is 100% Colton Simmons. You do a great job on it, man. It sounds great. It's produced really well, sharp. And you do it most of the time for free or on the cheapest of cheap. So props to you, dude.
It's a labor of love. We do a Patreon. There's a handful of beautiful people that have helped support us over the last year and a half.
Oh, my God. Yeah, if you're donating to the Patreon, thank you so much.
You're a hero.
We are not buying the bottle of wine with the Patreon money. That is going to equipment, and that is going to promotion. Yeah.
If you've enjoyed the show, we take monthly donations through Patreon, which is Patreon. I'm surprised I spelled it correctly with the bottle of wine.
You crushed it.
Patreon.com/thebackpew. All we ask for is $5 a month. You'd be surprised how fast that adds up. We only withdraw it like every 6 months to buy like a new microphone or a new MIDI. Just gear, essentially. I think in the long run, we'd like to maybe do a video podcast portion of that. Mm-hmm, so video equipment is expensive. We'd love to buy it.
Live stuff.
Yeah, stuff like that. We love to pay people who help us. So even if you only do it for a couple of months, you're not going to hurt our feelings if you donate and then you cancel it after a month.
Mm-hmm.
We don't care. It's all gravy. So patreon.com/thebackpew. And if you don't have $5, review us on iTunes. It's completely free.
It blows our minds that so many of you guys tune in and listen to this. And it's just super, super humbling, and we're so grateful. So thank you so much, guys. We love you. We'll see you guys in the back view.
See y'all.